Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
That he could make country strong and great again.
I've heard that somewhere else.
Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well trained, well equipped, and battle hardened.
There is not a liberal America and a conservative America. There is the United States of America.
Good night and good luck.
Hey, everybody, I'm Rick Wilson, your host for the Lincoln Project podcast. Thank you again for joining us for a really interesting episode this week. We're joined today by the authors of a tremendous new book called Our Dear Friends in Moscow, Andrei Soldatov and Arina Borogin. They are Russian expats who have chronicled the decline of this brief moment of hope after the fall of communism that Russia would somehow not slip back into the authoritarian mold, which unfortunately it has. And the story is kind of heartbreaking and tragic. And it shows the way that Vladimir Putin has corrupted even people who remain behind, who thought they were going to be part of resisting that slide back into authoritarianism. So guys, I want to thank you first off for coming on the show today. And either one of you lead out, tell me about how you got inspired to write this book at this time.
Thank you very much for having us here. That was not easy because when the war in Ukraine, the full-scale invasion of Ukraine started, it sounded like a shock to us, like a huge blow. We were shocked, angered, depressed, everything at one moment. And we could not believe that a lot of people in Russia, a lot of public intellectuals, many representatives of Russian intelligence, they demonstrated their support to the war. And that was, we couldn't believe that. And we started talking about that. And we have been talking constantly until the moment we decided to write the book to understand what happened with the Russian society, with the best and brightest of the Russian society. And because our former friends were among these people, so that's why we decided to write this book about our dear friends in Moscow. Back then, we were in exile in London already.
So a lot of the through line of this book is, and I can remember this because, you know, I at the end of the Cold War in the early 90s, there was a sort of blossoming in Russia of independent media, alternative media. You'd had 70 years of state radio, television, Pravda, all the things. But there was a moment, it seemed like, Russia was going to have a media that could hold power to account. And that has declined, I think, kind of in lockstep with Putin's rise to power. That decline has been very marked. Talk to us about what could have been and how he slowly took over and corrupted each of, you know, either drove them out or corrupted each of these media institutions that people had such high hopes for.
Well, unfortunately, it started before Putin came to power, just a few years before that, still under Boris Yeltsin, and for several reasons. One was that Russia waged a really unpopular war in Chechnya, and lots of people got really frustrated by this war. Also, there was a horrible corruption in the country, and people were not really happy there that either. And of course, this corruption also touched Russian media. And at some point, for instance, in the years of Perestroika, journalists were held on a very high pedestal. But by the mid, maybe by the late of 1990s, to be honest, people got really tired of journalists fighting for the oligarchs. What Putin did, he found a way how to use it very skillfully. First of all, he blamed journalists of being corrupt, of selling their countries to the enemies, including to the terrorists. And he explained to the Russian population that the Russian army, which used to be so great and powerful, lost their wars in Afghanistan and also, of course, in Chechnya because of journalists. Because journalists undermined Russian military morale. And that was taken at face value by many, many Russian people, especially after we got so many terrorist attacks. It was just an easy way to blame someone in your problems. So Putin found a way how to channel this anger and this fear into blaming and accusing journalists of being the public enemy.
Right. And you're right. He did take Beslan and other attacks that the Chechens executed and others executed and tried to hang them around the necks of his political enemies and to gather more power for himself. But in some of those cases, Putin was the one ordering some of those attacks from what some of the history has shown us. This was a very well executed thing by a guy with a strategic mind for authoritarianism. Did Russian civil society and media ever have a chance against a guy like Putin? Because he does, you know, he does, he's bloody minded. He goes right after what he wants and he doesn't play by any set of rules. Was there ever a moment where you think as civil institutions and the media could have gotten ahead of a Putin figure?
I think the Russian society definitely had a chance to fight Putin, but what happened? Many intellectuals, as I said, that back then they didn't recognize the threat because it happened that when Putin came to power, soon after that, the oil prices has risen and Russians became much more wealthy than they used to be. And a lot of money were channeling Putin spent a lot of money for buying the public intellectuals. And they got this money and they decided that everybody knew that Vladimir Putin came from the KGB. He's a former KGB officer. And few public intellectuals had illusions about that. But the use for him was he is adequate to the situation because he can make that he could make country strong
and great again.
And great again.
I've heard that somewhere else.
Make Russia great again. So what they think, what they explain, and that's how it happened. But the chance was there. There were a lot of chances, but not a lot of people decided to fight Putin and the Kremlin.
Talk to me about some folks in this book that you profile. Who do you find like the most tragic of these people who has been corrupted by Putin and become part of that organizational authoritarian compromise?
Well, probably the most tragic character in our book is a woman, Svetlana Babaeva. She was a very well-connected political journalist, a very experienced one. She worked extensively under Yeltsin, and she reported Yeltsin before she became really close to Vladimir Putin. And among our friends and the people we describe in the book, she probably enjoyed the closest access to Vladimir Putin. She was part of his presidential pool. She traveled with him. She knew and called on first names many Russian ministers and the members of his inner circle. And she was really fascinated by this access, by this closeness. Putin skillfully played on her feelings, and at some point he could have asked her for advice. And it sounds very appealing. Sure. Very interesting for you if you are a journalist and you are asked by the all-powerful president to help you with the choice of your tie, for instance. It sounds silly, but unfortunately it corrupts journalists in many countries, and of course it corrupted her to the point that once she lost her access to Putin, and that happened, mm-hmm. Because it is a totalitarian system and you cannot predict everything. And even for Svetlana Babayeva, she was found too liberal, probably, by the Kremlin. So when she lost this access, she got so desperate and she almost lost her sanity. So she wanted to find this new drug instead of the drug provided by this access to the Kremlin. So she enlisted with special forces and she started doing all this, well, crazy exercises with Russian special forces. She became really good at it by the moment when the full-scale invasion started in 2022, to the point that she wanted to fight in Ukraine, not as an embedded journalist, but as a soldier. So she went through more trainings with Russian special forces, and she got killed by friendly fire at a shooting range by a Russian soldier. And I think it's just a fascinating story of a very well-connected, very sophisticated young woman who became corrupt and by this closeness of power and got killed by this brutal and terrible regime just because it's how it works in a country like Russia these days.
Authoritarian regimes in the modern era have access to something much broader than they had in the past. During Hitler and Stalin and Mao, radio was the pinnacle of communications tools to reach the mass audience. Now, you see that Russia, although they look like journalistic outlets, have things that are that make Fox News in America look like weak tea. They have explain to Americans how Russians get their news out of this sort of Kremlin-shaped media bubble that exists today. Because I don't think Americans have a realization of just how narrow and how much control Putin exercises over the Russian media.
How Russians consume media? They consume it in two ways. Older generations and people who live in Russian regions, they consume a lot of the Kremlin's TV channels. So all TV channels are under the control of the Kremlin and they're full of propaganda. But that's not like boring propaganda that they use. How it was during the communist era, where it was just all the anchors talking about very boring stuff about the communist party. That's not like that. There are a lot of quarrels in the air. There are a lot of rude words. It's very conversational, so that's kind of interesting propaganda. And this is the first source of information for Russians. But another one is social media. That's YouTube, still Facebook, Russian analog of Facebook VKontakte, and also Telegram channels, which are we call Telegram channels as the channels that everyone can set up on social media called Telegram and translate everything she or he want. And these channels used by so-called war correspondents, war propagandists, and that's very, very interesting stuff. That's not like just propaganda. There are a lot of footage from the war, a lot of footage from the Moscow streets. Just it's shootings on Moscow streets. Video from battlefields and a lot of very aggressive and emotional commentaries. So that's how Russians consume their information.
We'll be right back. And now back to the show. It's hard for Americans who've grown up in this very diverse media culture, where there are people on the right and people on the center and people on the left, and the right has a very good media infrastructure in America. The left is not as good, but it's difficult, I think, sometimes for Americans to understand just how integral this Russian media machine is to controlling the population and to shaping the reality. But sometimes it breaks through. And what I wanted to ask you about was attacks by Ukraine and Operation Spiderweb on strategic Russian aviation assets. So do you think the average Russian citizen is getting any kind of news out of this that gives them a clear picture of what happened? And just because Ukraine has taken the fight home to Russia, they are now attacking inside the Russian heartland. Is this slipping through to average Russians in any way whatsoever?
Yes. Yes, definitely. And we know that even the Russian Ministry of Defense is not really happy with all this coverage, because ordinary Russians, they also tend to take pictures or record videos when they witness something really interesting, like something hit a airport. That is why there are so many videos right now available on Telegram channels. And lots of people watch these videos and talk about that. The problem is not the lack of information, but the challenge to make any sense out of it. Because there are so many gossips, there are so many conspiracy theories, there are so many trash information, which is not real information, or false and fake videos and fake photographs, which is really, all of that makes things really difficult to process. There is also a sense which is, to be honest, quite widespread among ordinary Russians that, look, yes, now we see Ukrainians attacking us, which means that Russia is under attack. So we need to unite and fight back and all of that. And the problem is that when you live in a cycle of news, which is very short, you actually think only of the most recent news, which is the attacks of the Ukrainians on Russia. So you don't give a think or thought to actually why the Ukrainians are attacking Russian cities and towns and regions. So nobody wants to talk about 2022 or about the annexation of Crimea in 2014. You get focused only on the most recent news bit. And that also is used by the Kremlin to send this message that Russia is a besieged fortress, needs to be protected and defended.
And the very important factor here is fear, because people are just feared to say the truth. They're very fearful to tell the truth, and they're very fearful talking about the truth, because Russia adopted a very repressive legislation recently, which prohibits people to say anything about the war, to criticize the Russian army, to say anything good about the West. So anyone could be punished for telling the truth.
That to me, having gone through, the story here, it is sort of a through line that the truth is a weapon that the authoritarian side of this equation has broken. And I worry and I wonder, I've spent a fair amount of my early life studying the Russians. I wonder if you feel like there's any hope in a post-Putin era or a post-Ukraine era. I mean, no one can tell how this war is going to end at this point. But if it ends badly for Russia, I don't think Putin lasts as long as he would like to last. He may be the guy falling out the window this time. My concern is that between the oligarchs and this established media system in Russia, it sort of may have poisoned a couple of generations of Russians against the real truth about what's happening, against the objective, evils that have been done in their name.
Yes, and unfortunately, it's not anymore only about the oligarchs and the media. We got several generations of the veterans of Putin's wars, starting with the Second Chechen War. So we have veterans who fought Putin's wars in Chechnya, in Georgia, in Ukraine, in Syria. All of them are extremely against the West. All of them do not want to have any democracy in the country. And even if they are sometimes very critical of Putin, they're critical of him because they believe him to be too soft. They actually want to have this war bigger because they believe that this is an existential war with the West. So my problem is that even when we think that at some point Putin would be gone, he would be dead or whatever, the next leader would not be necessarily extremely liberal. This is one of the concerns. But of course, because we are Russians and to be honest, we still believe that at some point we could get back to our country. But it was a period of time in the recent history of Russia when we enjoyed some freedoms, and there was this sense that we might be part of the global community of peoples who sort of understand each other. Obviously, it doesn't look like now, but still, we had this hope, and I really believe that at some point we can, get it back.
That idea of that idea that, you know, Putinism will survive Putin. Is it with those veterans? Is it Duganism that's infected them more? That sort of idea of what Russia is in the world that's poisoned them to and sort of kept them framed up in that nationalist bubble?
Dugin's idea, you're right. Dugin's ideas they fit the Putin's narrative, but for average Russian, for the average Russian, it's as this. This narrative is too complicated. I learned a lot of Dugin and back in the 90s. Back then, I looked at this as like some entertaining stuff because nobody paid attention to his philosophy, and he was a figure of subculture. But
he has a lot of followers in the West now.
I mean, I was interested.
He has a lot of fans in America, unfortunately.
But I don't think that a lot of Russians know Putin's idea, Dugin's idea, because it's too complicated. But the stuff about that Russia is empire and it should get back all the territories which somewhere was Russian. So that's the idea. It's very understandable by many Russians. Dugin expressed this idea in more complicated form, but that's what rings a bell in Russian souls.
We'll be right back. And now, back to the show. One of the things that this Russian media apparatus, this Russian social media apparatus has been very successful at doing is persuading a lot of people in America and in the West that Putin's the good guy. And, you know, we see that in our own administration right now with J.D. Vance, who is pretty overtly pro-Putin. Trump, who is a fool, but sort of ensnared by the idea of being a peer to Putin, which, you know, if you've studied Putin at all, you would laugh your ass off about that, because Putin is a much more sly and crafty and experienced individual than Trump ever could be. You talk a little bit about, you know, some of the ways that can you talk a little bit about some of the ways that Americans get taken in by Russian state media and by Russian? It's almost like they want to spread that corruption of truth over this side of the Atlantic.
Well, the problem is that I vividly remember how Russia Today has been changing over the years. It started as a very boring propaganda outlet. Nobody watched it. It was too boring. It was all about promoting Russian forest and nature. Like, you need to visit Russia because it's so beautiful. But at some point, they understood that it's better to talk not about Russia, but about the West and the problems in the West. And they started skillfully exploiting problems that Western society has. The idea that, look, we can exploit your fears of the changes in your life, of the changes in your environment. For instance, you have gays now, and they can invade you and change your way of life. And this is the biggest threat to your way of life. And we in Russia, we don't have this problem because we have our traditional values. That sounds very appealing to many people. also the idea that we see not in the United States, but in many European countries, that Putin presents the only alternative to the United States. And it's not really healthy when you have just one country ruling the world. We need to have some other center, something else. And China doesn't sound really appealing, but Putin is such a strong leader. He actually can say no to the American president, and that sounds very appealing. So, well, the Kremlin propaganda skillfully exploits these kind of things.
Yeah, I had a lot of experience on a totally separate issue, proving this in a legal case about that RT was tied to the Kremlin and that they were an essential element of state propaganda, you know, that was being used against the West. It was a crazy experience because you sort of know it empirically, but the more you drill down on it, the more, you know, you see how much it's been rebranded in the West as a really vital tool of Putin and of the autocratic movement there. So before we wrap up, you know, you guys were in Russia last in 2019, I think I read. And you couldn't go there and stay out of jail, essentially, is my understanding.
The thing is that after the full-scale invasion started, I was put on the wanted list of Russian authorities. So if I get back, it's up to 10 years in prison, and Rin is my, so to say, criminal accomplice. So we can't get back.
So for telling the truth about a war that's now cost Russia a million young men. What would you say if you could speak to your colleagues and your friends in Moscow that you write about in this book today? What would you say to them, you know, in hopes of trying to change their hearts and minds?
We talked to them while writing the book. So we discussed a lot of things. Those who agreed to talk to us, we discussed a lot of issues. And what we felt that was inevitable that we break up because our views were too different and they become absolutely different. I talked to one guy who I spent a lot of time talking to him, with a guy who's a journalist and who wrote an article calling for the final solution of the Ukrainian question, which reminds the language of Hitler's in Nazi Germany. And my relatives, they live in Ukraine because my father, he's from Ukraine. And so I'm constantly talking to them in Odessa and in Izmail. And my auntie, who is 87 years old, she lives by her own. And sometimes she needed to spend time outside because she's afraid of being buried under the rubble during the bombardment. And I talked with this guy about that. And what he said to me is that, Irina, that's a huge tragedy. I'm so sorry for you and for your loss, but we have to go further. My message to them, guys, you can't go further. You will pay.
There's some people going to end up in The Hague when this thing is all over. Andre and Irina, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show today. This book is, I will say the book made me sad, but it was also, you know, a cautionary tale for folks in other countries who face this kind of thing. Everybody, this is a terrific book. I hope you'll read it. It's called Our Dear Friends in Moscow, The Inside Story of a Broken Generation. Really terrific work. Get it wherever books are sold. And Andre and Irina, thank you again so much for coming on the show today. I really appreciate your time. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Thank you, Rick.
Thank you very much.
The Lincoln Project Podcast is a Lincoln Project production.
Executive produced by Whitney Hayes, Ben Howe, and Joey Wartner-Cheney. Edited by Riley Main.
Hey, folks, if you want to support the Lincoln Project's work against Donald Trump, Elon Musk, and this MAGA craziness, go to action.lincolnproject.us/helplp. If you'd like to get in touch or have suggestions for a guest or a show topic, or just want to say hi, our email is podcast@lincolnproject.us. For our MAGA friends, please, no more nudes. Thanks so much, and we'll talk to you again next time.
And good luck.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.